It is a big injustice that Pulp Fiction lost Best Picture to Forrest Gump. But here's the bigger injustice relating to these two films. There are Bubba Gump shrimp locations all over the country, and the only Jackrabbit Slims in existence is an unremarkable sports bar in Denver with no connection to the film. That's not fair. I'll try to recover from this travesty as we discuss Pulp Fiction, which was the number one movie in America.
The number one movie in America.
Movie in America.
Movie in America.
The number one movie in America.
This is the number one movie in America. My name's Sean Collier. I'm here with two unlikely police recruits. It's Robin Hitchcock.
Sound effect, sound effect, sound effect.
And Camila Adams.
Pew, 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 pew. You know, I am also outraged. I don't know if you use the word outraged, but about that there's no Jackrabbit Slims around.
I would also not say no to a big kahuna burger.
No. I hate to bring it up because I don't want to give the man any credit, but Harvey Weinstein did say we need to get Jackrabbit Slims all over the place. And
yeah.
And Tarantino stopped him because he was like, no, I was making fun of theme restaurants.
What a jit.
That restaurant seems legit fun.
Right?
And I
said, I'm like, you know what? I really want to go to a restaurant like that. Like, where can I find that?
In a car?
Yeah. That doesn't make any sense. You could have made so much money. So much money.
Before because we could do this forever. Before we fully leave Police Academy in the rearview mirror, so much has happened on the internet. Here are my favorite things I learned in response to our Police Academy episode. One, speaking of Michael Winslow, someone just tweeted, and I apologize, I didn't note who it was. Someone just tweeted at us to let us know that in the 90s, Michael Winslow did the Burger King training videos. Like when you got hired at Burger King and had to watch a video about how to do this and that. Ooh, it was really? Michael Winslow making sound effects.
Wow.
That's amazing. Like sizzle.
Right. Flip, presumably.
Cash register.
He would. Yeah, that seems right.
Your soul
Sam
dying.
Sam Panico from a friend of mine. Sam is a multi-talented guy, noted professional wrestler, also a cult movie expert.
Oh, I know BNS. Sam.
Yeah, you know.
Hi, Sam.
Sam knows everybody. BNSaboutmovies.com is his where his reviews go. There is basically a full, complete Police Academy movie that no one has ever seen that they did for a Sega CD interactive game.
What?
What?
With the amount of footage of a full film and the cast, and it was going to be like one of those early 90s, like you press a button and it does video that, you know, that then didn't get released and no one has ever seen it.
Oh my gosh.
I wonder who has it. Like, who is holding on to this and why?
I'm going
to
say Gutenberg. Probably Gutenberg. And finally, the thunderstorm of appreciation for short shorts and the thighs they expose. You know, we dragged Robin slightly for expressing her love of that anatomical feature, and an army came out to support her.
The people have spoken.
This is where we, okay, I guess the new trend, 2021, short shorts, who wears short shorts? Everyone.
Get leg warmers back at the same time, so it's only thighs. It's just
yes.
A window.
I'm into it. Let's do it.
But Police Academy aside, and what a week-over-week transition this is. Wow. Always great to revisit. You know, whatever you think about Pulp Fiction, there is just so much there.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
It's a lot to take in. It took me, I had to watch it in 3 installments.
Did you like sort of follow the plot guidelines of doing that?
What do you mean?
Because like it kind of breaks into 3 main pieces.
Oh, I guess not.
Okay.
No, I didn't.
So you made it harder on yourself.
Well, no, like I guess I would stop in like when we did like do the transition. I think I like stopped right before we went to Butch's section.
Okay.
And, you know, stuff like, and also I was like, whew, the whole a lot of Butch's section I can't watch.
Yeah. I don't want to get too far into the weeds right now, but while I was getting ready, I was thinking, like, what is there to be said about Pulp Fiction that hasn't already been said?
Right.
And I guess in a way that sort of made me feel like, well, there's no pressure on me to, like, crack the mm-hmm. code and decide whether or not this movie is what is good or bad. Nobody thinks it's bad. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So we can just bullshit about it.
Basically.
Yeah, exactly.
I figure we'll probably end up getting into our personal experiences behind it, around it. We were all very much alive when this came out, so, you know.
We lived through this.
Right. And this is probably one of the first ones in a while that we would all have, like, real memories around the release of this movie.
Right. It's funny how the ones, like, Chronicle, we don't have memories.
Right.
We're all full-on grown-ups when that came
right.
out. But
we're like, what?
Because we're full-on grown-ups, we don't care about Chronicle.
Right. Well, I mean, I guess we should get into Tarantino, because it's the first Tarantino we've done. And before we get to the recap and the segments, my memory is, you know, as still a child, I mean, I wasn't, you know, I wasn't even a teenager when this movie came out. But suddenly, there's this guy named Quentin Tarantino, who is apparently the most important thing in the world.
Right.
And I think that it is not an overstatement to say that this just changed everything. This just made mainstream movie. I mean, the 80s didn't end until this came out in a lot of ways. If you look at a lot of the dramas in 92 and 93 and what followed, you know, even as a 9-year-old when this came out, I could feel the shift.
Mm.
I agree.
This has been another installment of I'm Not As Old As Lots of People Think. But before we get into the Quentin question, let's get through the regular stuff. Beginning, you know, we've taken the most famously convoluted, windy, twisty, episodic, major motion picture plot in history and asked Camila Adams summarize it in 60 seconds. So let's see how that goes. And go.
Honey Bunny and Pumpkin rob a restaurant. Jules and Vincent kill some dudes and quote the Bible. Marcellus pays Butch to throw a fight. Vincent hangs out with Mia Wallace. They win a dance contest. She almost ODs. Ends the night with a needle in her chest. Christopher Walken tells a story about the war, a watch, and his butt. Instead of throwing the fight, Butch kills the man and is now on the run from Marcellus. Marcellus finds Butch, but they end up in a torture dungeon of some racist, rapist rednecks. Shit goes very wrong. Butch escapes and saves Marcellus, so they are cool. Divine Intervention gives Jules pause about his life choices, but Vincent accidentally kills a dude in their car. Tarantino unsuccessfully inserts himself into the film, is horrible for every frame. Mr. Wolf comes to fix Vincent and Jules' problem. Vincent and Jules go to have breakfast at the restaurant. Honey Bunny and Pumpkin are going to rob. Jules and Vincent survive the robbery, but by Jules being a smooth-talking badass. Finn.
Very well done.
Was it 46 seconds?
Even with the stumbles.
And you said racist, rapist, redneck. Mm-hmm. I can't believe I was able to say that correctly in a slow way.
That was rough.
Which is just a good tongue twister for so many, you know, small internet savvy fringe groups in 2020. You know, you could call them by the name they say, but you could also say racist, rapist. No, see, I couldn't say it.
Racist, rapist, rednecks.
All right, good job. Now do it again in chronological order of events. Go. No.
I had rewatching this, and I've probably only seen this like maybe 3 times all the way through. There are so many. There were different. Like for one, all right. You know what? Never mind. I'm getting ahead of myself. We'll do the thing, and then we'll get into it.
Okay.
You know what? Let's just dispatch with the bullshitting in between the segments and go straight to Faxy, because
it's going to be all bullshitting.
To avoid having to say wait, just have a conversation.
Right.
Plenty and nothing here, because if you start listing facts about Pulp Fiction, you now have an entire college class, not a you know, 5-minute segment. But here's some of it. Pulp Fiction was released October 14th, 1994. It was the 27th number one film of that year. Not a platform release. It was not a limited release. It was number one in its first weekend. Although barely, Pulp Fiction earned $9.3 million that weekend, just beating the Sylvester Stallone action flick The Specialist, which came in second in its second weekend with $8.9 million. other new releases didn't really threaten. Wes Craven's New Nightmare came out in third, 6.6. Little Giants came out in fifth with 4.7 million. Exit to Eden came out in eighth with $3 million. Not really any other competition. Pulp Fiction did hang on to the top spot in its second weekend, $8.3 million. It fell to second the following week to the debuting Stargate. As you might imagine, Pulp Fiction was in theaters forever. Ordinarily, I'll tell you how long it was in the top 10. Usually when things fall out of the top 10, they're gone altogether pretty much immediately after. That was not the case here. At first, Pulp Fiction was only in the top 10 for 6 weeks, which is pretty normal. But it just kind of hung around floating below the top 10 for a while, long enough to get into Oscar season when it was the buzziest thing of the year. It was nominated for 7 awards. So suddenly, around awards time, it starts coming back up, briefly re-enters the top 10, peaking again at number 6, you know, during the awards campaign. The point is, it was in the top 10 for 6 weeks. It was in the top 15 for 27 weeks.
Damn.
Wow. That, like, doesn't happen in the 90s.
No. Right.
Outside of, like, Lion King.
Right, right. Well, and oddly enough, you know, the Forrest Gump did the same thing. This was happening to two movies.
Okay, yeah.
Forrest Gump and Pulp Fiction, which were 1 and 2 in the Oscar race, and just came out at some point in 94 and never left. But Pulp Fiction debuted at number 1 in October of 94, did not leave theaters probably until the end of April the following year. Speaking of the Oscars, Pulp Fiction received 7 Oscar nominations. Let's see how quickly Robin answers all of these questions. Pulp Fiction only won 1 award. It
original
was...
original screenplay.
Correct. As mentioned, it lost picture to Forrest Gump. It was nominated for Best Director. It lost to...
also, Robert Zemeckis won for Forrest Gump.
John Travolta was nominated for Best Actor. He lost to
Tom Hanks. Sam Jackson lost to Martin Landau. Uma Thurman lost to Diane Wiest.
Yes.
I don't know what the other 2 nominations were.
That's it. It won Best Screenplay, Picture, Director, Actor, Supporting Actor, Supporting Actress. Oh, and was nominated for Editing. It lost to...
Speed.
Forrest Gump. We'll get back to it. But yes, that's 4 different Oscars, including Best Picture, where Forrest Gump beat... I mean, hey, Pulp Fiction was a new thing at the time. And
A tiny part of me wants to rewatch Forrest Gump to decide if it is as bad as I think it is.
I don't know if it's bad, but it's just more... I wouldn't call it revolutionary in any way, shape, or form. I mean, maybe some of their, you know, inserting Forrest in, you know, some old footage and whatnot. But I think probably there was just a lot of people who, we've always done it this way, who weren't like, who weren't about to give up an Oscar to Pulp Fiction.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I think that just Forrest Gump has, and I think it's partially because of like Pulp Fiction people being grumpy about it, but like Forrest Gump is remembered as being like so boomer masturbatory and ableist and overly long and a soundtrack wearing a movie suit, and I don't really remember it that clearly, so I'm curious if I watched it now as a movie, would I go north of 50? That's my question.
I think it'd go north of 50. Oh, I think I think it is probably, and I haven't seen it in forever either. If I remember correctly, as a, you know, when I was 9 or 10 and becoming aware of what grown-up movies were, I was allowed to watch Forrest Gump. Certainly not allowed to watch Pulp Fiction.
Same.
But so I think I saw it at the time.
It was like a deal for me that I wasn't allowed to watch Pulp Fiction because, like, you know, my like after school treat was watching Terminator 2, which is horribly inappropriate for children. And I was aware of the buzz going around Pulp Fiction. At this point, I was watching the Oscars every year and I wanted to watch it. And my dad was like, no, when you're older. And he almost never did that. And I was very upset about it.
But I bet Forrest Gump is better than it might be and not as good as it should be given winning all the Oscars and, you know, being a mega hit.
That's also because, I mean, Tom Hanks, like, come on. Like, you throw somebody else in there as Forrest Gump and you'd be like, you'd probably be like, yeah, that was just like a big deal. I don't understand what the big deal was back then, but, you know, still it's just like, oh, Tom. Yeah.
You throw someone else in and you have Sean Penn in I Am Sam.
Never go full.
Let's see. Other awards. It won plenty of awards. It won the Palme d'Or. It won BAFTAs for screenplay. And Samuel L. Jackson. It won the Golden Globe for best screenplay. It won 4 Independent Spirit Awards, including Samuel L. Jackson in the lead actor category.
Okay. Well, put a pin in it. I'm so glad that that is a thing. Mm. Keep going.
Yeah. There's one. It might be an Independent Spirit Award, but one of the second tier but real award ceremonies also had a supporting actor nomination for Eric Stoltz, of all the people in this movie. That's who got him, who snuck one in.
I'll allow it.
Yeah. He is very well cast.
Yeah.
Yes, he's great. Finally, here's 3 fun facts that are not the normal ones people say about Pulp Fiction, because they're the ones that caught my attention during this round of viewing. In 2008, Tarantino revealed 3 of the people who almost played these roles. Bruce Willis, Butch, that was written specifically for Matt Dillon.
Huh.
Okay.
Yeah, would not have worked. I mean, all of these are.
As much as I like to look at Matt Dillon.
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't know. Yeah, Bruce does bring a certain something to it.
Mm-hmm. Wait.
Yes. Vincent Vega. Yes. Vincent Vega was, I don't know how close this was. There was interest from the Daniel Day-Lewis camp in the Vincent Vega role.
No.
What?
No.
Ooh.
He would have probably gone out and actually murdered some people just to prepare for the role.
I need to know what it's like. And finally, Jules was supposed to be Lawrence Fishburne, who turned it down because he thought he was beyond doing supporting roles at that point in his career.
He is correct.
Okay, he is correct, but is it a supporting role?
That's yeah, true, but also I would argue to think that Lawrence Fishburne wasn't necessarily saying that he was beyond supporting roles, just shit talking, you know, loudmouth black man stereotypical
yes. black male role.
Yeah,
got it.
Exactly.
You are definitely onto something there, because that makes so much more sense than thinking that Jules is not an important enough character, because he is as important as Vincent Vega.
Oh, absolutely.
His part in the movie comes later.
Yeah, I would even argue to say he was so more important.
Perhaps that's what Lawrence Fishburne told people. It's just when really he's like, I'm not saying all of these words in this way.
Right.
And Samuel L. Jackson said, oh, I will.
Right. Exactly. Motherfucker, yeah. I will.
And thank God he did.
Yeah. This blew my mind because of all of the little, like, did you catch this in the way that Pulp Fiction is? I had never heard this one, and it's perfect. Whenever Vincent Vega goes to the bathroom, something terrible happens. In chronological order.
Oh, wow.
Interesting,
He goes to the bath. This is chronological, not movie order. In chronological order, he goes to the bathroom, emerges, and the diner is being robbed.
Mm.
Then he goes to the bathroom, emerges, and Mia has overdosed. Then he goes to the bathroom, emerges, and he's immediately shot and killed.
Wow. That's an interesting little tidbit there.
I would not have thought of that.
Me either.
Got that one. Finally, there's an entire Wikipedia page called something like Unrealized Quentin Tarantino Projects. Here is just a list, a very incomplete list of things that Tarantino said he was going to do and has not yet gotten around to, including Iron Man. He wanted to do Iron Man.
Oh, thank God he did
not. In 1992. He completed a script for a Silver Surfer movie immediately after Reservoir Dogs. And then there was a big moment of what is he going to do next? It ended up being Pulp Fiction. He dallied with a Luke Cage movie. Speed. He was in talks to direct Speed. And Men in Black. He was in talks to direct Men in Black when he chose Pulp Fiction. He was first attached to the Man from U.N.C.L.E. Big screen version, which sat in development hell for like 20 years before it eventually came out. He was fairly deep on working on a remake of Faster Pussycat Kill Kill, got as far as saying that his choices were Kim Kardashian, Britney Spears, and Eva Mendes.
No.
Was he... What?
I've never heard anything that made me go, that makes no sense, and that makes perfect sense at the same time. Oh, as Quentin Tarantino remaking Faster Pussycat with those 3.
Right. Oh, God.
I don't want anything. I'm really glad that a lot of these things are unrealized.
Right.
And these are the four, concluding with the four that really came close, the Vega Brothers movie, because Michael Madsen from Reservoir Dogs and Vincent Vega, or John Travolta from this movie, are brothers, canonically.
What? Yeah.
Yes.
There's supposed to be a universe. Are we supposed to know
that? They're both named Vega.
Vega. It's just supposed to be like a... And plus, there's like this whole supposed Tarantino universe.
Character in both movies? Are they the same person?
No.
No.
Does he have a twin brother? What's going on?
His character in Pulp Fiction is supposed to be Mr. White's nephew from Reservoir Dogs, I think.
And if deleted scenes are canon,
no.
Vincent and Vic Vega are brothers. Their cousin is the real-life person Suzanne Vega. In a deleted scene from this movie, Mia jokes like, oh, any relation to Susan Vega? And Vic's like, she's my cousin.
Oh, that's amazing.
Forever, they were talking about a Vega Brothers movie. Tarantino has now said, yeah, they're too old now. And
well, both yeah.
of their characters have died. So that's probably not going to happen. There was real movement on a crossover film, Django/Zorro, where the Jamie Foxx Django would meet Zorro. Don't know how, that was in the works. a remake of Less Than Zero apparently was really close. The Star Trek movie got really, really close, where Tarantino was going to do one of the Star Trek sequels in the current series. Apparently there's a script, but he's not going to direct it anymore. And still, 20 years later, the closest thing to actually happening in all of these unrealized projects is Kill Bill Volume 3. That was set up at the time perfectly. As soon as the second one came out, he said, yeah, Volume 3 is when the daughter of Vivica A. Fox's character comes for the daughter of the bride.
Oh, I'm here for that.
Yes.
Yeah. Yes,
I'm here for all of that.
And I'll be curious if the bride doesn't die horribly.
Right?
He said at the time that if he did it, that would be the opening scene. Yes.
Okay, great.
I don't know if that's still the plan, but he did say that after he and Uma patched things up, after that whole mess, that as recently as last year, they were talking about Volume 3.
So. I hope her daughter, Uma's daughter, plays the bride's daughter.
Oh, shit.
That would be
we waited long enough
dope.
For that to make sense.
Right? That would be dope.
Well, all of that aside, this movie, where to begin? I don't know. Somebody say something.
Well, let's just get it out there. Okay, so you guys were still babies, I guess,
yes.
when this movie came out.
I was 10, yeah.
I was graduating from high school and plotting my whatever college plans or whatnot at this point. And I didn't see it until probably like 2 years later when I was in college, maybe. But this is just like, I lived through a time period. I went to film school and it was just like, you couldn't walk anywhere without hearing some dude talk about Tarantino. Like, I have lived so long that I am just like yes, just like Quentin Tarantino is like, you know, the end all be all. Like, it was everybody on everybody's lips. And so, like, I think I kind of, for a while, I rejected him. And still, there's still like a, I'm still got
a. That'll never totally go away.
Right, yeah. I'm still battling with him every time. And I'm pretty sure I've already given up. I refuse to watch any more QT movies other than this Volume 3 of Kill Bill. I will go ahead and agree to that now. So like, when I finally did see Pulp Fiction, I am sure it was on VHS or whatever. Tarantino has this, he's so fucking dialogue heavy, and he has this way of dialogue where it's like he sucks you into this really in-depth dialogue and you forget what the fuck you're watching and what's yeah. supposed to be happening. And I do this every time. I've probably seen From Dusk Till Dawn like 100 times. Every time I watch that movie, I always forget. Oh, yeah, it's a fucking vampire movie. Like, I'm surprised yep. when the vampires show up.
Doesn't it take a while?
Yeah, it does.
I haven't seen that movie in a long time.
It does. But still, it's like, you know, I know you know what you're getting into. But I'm still like, oh, yeah, that's right. And so with this, like, Pulp Fiction, he's really good at that. But it's also in a way, it's like, damn, I would hate to have to get stuck talking to him at a party. Like,
that's the nightmare. Having a conversation with Quentin Tarantino would be the worst thing that could happen to me today. Like, I could step into an electrified puddle and get COVID, and that would be preferable to having to converse with Quentin Tarantino.
Yes, this is true. So, yeah, I mean, this movie is... And I remembered why I don't own it, and it's because of the Butch's storyline. That's some dark, dark shit.
And so
the Gimp, that's rough.
Yeah, I have it on my my notes here. How do we feel about this?
Like, okay, this is what I'm going to say. The thing that is frustrating to me about that segment of the movie is that Quentin Tarantino wrote rape into this story, not because he has anything to think or say about a man being raped. Mm-hmm. Like, there is something potentially there with this super masculine guy who is like high status in every room he's ever in, gets raped. Mm-hmm. Okay. And Quentin Tarantino does not deal with that at all. He put it in there because it's shocking and because he probably watched Deliverance while he was writing this movie and was like, oh, another thread to weave into my little pastiche of every movie I've ever seen.
Right.
And that's insulting.
I mean, I think that you said last week, you know, we're not going back to 1984, but we are going back to 1994. It's 26 years.
What?
Yes.
Damn.
That can't be right. You got to check your math on that one.
Right. I think that this was unexamined in the same way at the time.
It was examined in Deliverance in 1972 with the same amount of lack of depth, with just a man being raped.
Well, right. I mean, that
3 years before Prince of Tides, spoiler alert.
But in a mainstream film,
Prince of Tides was nominated for Best Picture! Deliverance was nominated for Best Picture!
Yeah, I don't want to get far in defense. I mean, okay. This is a devil's advocate argument. My devil's advocate argument is, I don't think in 1994 it was shocking to go, what's the most terrible thing that could happen to you suddenly? It's like being raped and murdered. We don't need to think about it beyond that. That's not to say that it shouldn't have been. I do think you're right. I don't think this was examined or explored. And I think now that we are much more aware of when rape and the threat of rape is being tossed around casually in a movie, it'd be going like, I think, especially like, clearly this is all just to be shocking, because what happens to me in that scene is I go, wait, can we explore the Gimp a little bit more? There's just a guy that lives in that box.
That's what I was wondering too.
Which to me says they're not actually thinking about any of these things. They're just like, how fucked up and BDSM weird can we make it? Mm-hmm. And, you know, there are relatively few things that take points away from Pulp Fiction in my mind. That's one of them. It's not simply, oh, there's a rape scene. That's what, you know, a lot of people, this comes up in stand-up annoyingly frequently. It's like, what, just because it's about rape, it's a rape joke? P.S. Yes. Mm-hmm, but I'm not saying I don't like anything with rape scenes. It's like the fact that this is, as Robin said, not investigated, not explored, just thrown in as, wouldn't it be terrible if?
Well, I think, and by far still not like being pro this scene or whatever, I feel like it comes from the point of view of, all right, what could Butch do to make Marcellus be like, I'm not going to kill you?
Right.
And that's probably, and even if Butch had just saved his life, it still probably would have been like, nah, you're still going to have to do something. You're still going to have to pay me something, blah, 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 what you owe me. But from saving him from something, from not really saving him from, but the whole damn situation of rape. Right, exactly. Ending the whole thing and coming.
But how much do you think it's the agreeing to not tell anyone about it? And
oh,
frankly,
I'm sure.
I think that I'm.
Yeah, I'm sure.
Giving it way too much credit, even asking that question.
And I'm sure it's a lot of it, but it's also that, how can he be sure that he's not going to tell anybody about it? But yeah, it's also like the not telling about it as well. And then there's also, and I would also think, but we don't get to see it, is that, you know, what's the worst thing that to most men, what's the worst thing that could happen to them to justify them going full ape shit and just like dismembering and shoot and killing and just murder and just like going full medieval on somebody's ass.
Yeah, but he's gone full medieval on people for like being late on a loan payment. I'm sure of it.
I'm sure. Yeah, but I'm just, yeah. And also, we're also kind of, I think almost every Quentin Tarantino movie, we get forced, his fetishes get forced upon us. with like, like the feet. I'm absolutely positive this dude has some sort of foot fetish.
When Once Upon a Time in Hollywood came out, I saw multiple tweets, and I don't think it was the same people making the same joke. I think people had this legit experience of seeing that movie in the theater, and when her feet show up on the movie seat, someone else in the audience went, foot.
And then also, like, Butch's little girlfriend, I can't stand her.
Oh, my God.
I like her.
Of course you do. Of course you do.
This one's blueberry pancakes.
What? A tiny woman who wants to eat a lot of food? Oh, yeah. I've never seen this in cinema.
I want a poochie belly.
She's so strange. She's not like other girls.
Like,
he hits her, and then when she comes back, she's like, hi, honey, can I get on your motorcycle? It's not a motorcycle, baby. It's a chopper. Okay.
Does he hit her?
Yes.
That's a shame.
Yeah. I remember recently seeing a review of this that was like, it doesn't have any violence against women. And I was like,
I am.
Pretty sure it does.
Beg your pardon?
Yeah, he hits her because he's mad at her for not picking up the watch.
The butt watch.
Which, by the way, I know that it's the plot driver. He could have just taken the watch with him.
Who needs a pop start in that moment?
Right, right.
Take the gun to the shitter with you.
As big as this watch is, what, he can't wear that to the arena? Like, why is that on the list of things she has to go pick up? Just
exactly.
Keep your watch on.
Yeah, so the chemistry between Travolta and Sam Jackson is phenomenal. Like, they are by far my favorite part of this entire, my favorite portion of this entire movie. Just everything that they say to each other, how they talk and interact with each other is a thing of beauty. And
their rhythm.
Yeah. It's just so good. And I forget, is this was the one that, you know, that brought John Travolta back to everybody's back to the public eye. Rightfully so, that he got his comeuppance. He came back with a vengeance.
Yeah. And looking less attractive than he has.
Yes.
In 90, I mean, I guess if you exclude, of his 20th century movies, let's put it that way, this is definitely far down on the list of how good looking he is.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Like, his head is like full on square, like cube.
He's got very rectangular.
Speaking of, when Mia calls him a square and draws a square, she actually draws a rectangle.
Take a second, take. Or don't literally highlight her mistake.
Exactly.
Oh, it's been bothering me since the first time I saw this movie.
It speaks to her. I didn't think this while I'm watching it, but now that we're talking about it, it speaks to her star power that she is absolutely the, like, icon of this film.
Yeah.
And is not in it that much.
Right.
That, you know, that it, in the poster and in the, you know, the hype afterwards. And, you know, when you think of Pulp Fiction, she's the first thing you picture. And she's in 10% of this movie. And the last you see of her is like a little throwaway line when they're going into the Butch's empty dressing room.
Swimming cap on.
Yes.
Yes. Oh, yeah. That's the last time.
Right.
Yeah.
And it's cute.
But especially the center, Samuel L. Jackson, Travolta and Uma are such stars from beginning to end. And as good as their chemistry is together, my Travolta apex is his speech to himself in the bathroom after the dance contest.
Yeah.
Yes.
Don't be rude. Drink your drink. Like, if that were 45 minutes long, I would have watched it. That was great.
So, like, talking about, like, the Tarantino universe, like, I kind of went, like, way down a rabbit hole with this last night. There's just way too much. It'll make you fucking crazy if you try to connect all the dots and all that stuff. But there are, like, a couple of little nods other than, like, you know, the Red Apple cigarettes and everything and all that stuff. Like, one of the things, and I think, was it Tim Roth's character in Reservoir Dogs that says garçon, and then the waitress corrects him and says garçon means boy?
I didn't know that was also in Reservoir Dogs.
I'm pretty sure it was.
That's adorable.
I could be totally wrong, listeners, but I'm pretty sure, and I didn't bother to do the Googling, but yeah, I think it is. It's like a little nods like that. And there was something else. There's like a lot of vocabulary that gets used in Tarantino's films. And I'm sure, you know, it's like, is it lazy writing or is it purposeful? Like, is he
right? Is he recycling himself because he is like Sorkin and just thinks that he's a constant font of genius, or is he trying to make a deeper connective tissue for all of these works of art?
Like make a fun experience for his viewer.
Right.
Camila, when did you drop out on Tarantino, to get back to that?
I think
you watched the beginning of Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. I remember you talking about it on the show.
Exactly. Django was at the end of Django, I was furious. I walked out of the theater like, fuck this dude, fuck this dude, fuck this dude. I was basically done with him then. And then Hollywood came out and I was like, I really don't want to do this. But somebody said, hey, Timothy Oliphant's in it. And I'm like,
oh, yeah. Oh, his part's good.
I never even got to it. I was like, I can't even.
Maybe just watch that one scene.
I was like, I can't. I'm not doing this with you anymore. I'm done with you. We're broken up. So like 20 minutes, half hour into Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. That's what.
And you skipped Hateful Eight.
Yeah.
Good call.
Yeah.
It's bad.
No, that's. I You're love murder like mysteries and westerns. And Jennifer Jason Leigh.
But like, I really love like Death Proof.
I never saw that one.
I kind of liked his story in Four Rooms, Pulp Fiction, Reservoir Dogs.
I love Jackie Brown. That's probably my favorite.
You know what? I don't think I've ever actually seen it all the way through.
Okay. I know you say you're done.
I know. I mean, to go back, like I am fully prepared and okay with going back to watch Jackie Brown. Okay. I don't need to see any more of his newer stuff because if I got to listen to this motherfucker, like throw. Okay. So a lot of my points were deducted for this film. As much as I do enjoy this film, and as much as I think this film is a great piece of cinema, there is no fucking need for this motherfucker to throw around the N-word as much as he does. And for him himself to put himself on screen and say it with a hard R. Like, are you kidding me right now? Like five times in a row and his character is supposed to be married to a black woman. Are you fucking kidding me? There's no fucking way he would have lived that long knowing that she's like, if that woman
and
in his house.
He talks about how she doesn't take any shit.
Right. So there's just no need for it. For first of all, just the fact that he's not a good actor, he's not a great screen presence. Nobody wants to see him on screen. Like, why do you keep doing this?
He's actually best in Dusk Till Dawn. That's where.
Oh yeah, that's right. That was the other one.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Anyway,
his ridiculous character makes sense in that ridiculous movie.
Right. But it's just like it was just unnecessary. And it's just over and over again. And I fear that Samuel L. Jackson has given him an honorary black card. And he thinks that
he's not entitled to do.
Right. So a lot of points were lost for the fact of for just his excessive and abusive use of the word. And it's just unnecessary.
I think that's totally valid.
I think that scene is the evidence you need to push away any other theoretical justification. In Django, which has plenty of its own problems.
Right.
Listen, you can justify to me that any movie set in that year is going to have the word.
Right.
Absolutely. You can justify me anytime Samuel L. Jackson is saying it.
Right.
Because
I feel like that's that's part of his normal life. I'm pretty sure that's what he does.
But there is no, even in other
you just don't need it. You do not need it. You don't even need it in Django, frankly. Like, I agree with you. I'm like, if that's what they want to do, like, fine. And I'm white, and so, like, I'm not going to be the arbiter of who gets to do this and who doesn't, but I'm for damn sure that Quentin Tarantino does not.
No.
And I think that the fact that he did, and that Eric Stoltz does, and at least another white character, made a lot of white people my age feel like they could do that.
Mm-hmm.
There's some bizarre, like, Chris Rock had a bit about this one point where white people wanted to be able to say it if they were rapping along with a song. There's, I think, for the few specific areas where Tarantino is clearly a smart and gifted person, he has a lot of basic ass shit in his psyche. And one of these is this love of being a certain breed of pretentious, too smart for their own good white guy has a love of being transgressive in ways that they technically are not transgressing. Mm. Right.
Mm-hmm.
Which is not to diminish this. But there's a stupid thing where some people love an excuse to do a thing they're not allowed to ordinarily do.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And so I think it was just exciting to him. Like, if it's my character, then I can say it all damn day.
Right.
I didn't really say it. It's like, fuck off. Like, way to taint your own movie for like a weird little like I'm breaking the rules thrill for you.
Right.
It's not like he learned his lesson.
No. He just keeps going all in. Just
like, right.
And which is why I just can't do it with him anymore. Oh, Quentin.
But he's made a bunch of my favorite movies, so I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, it's difficult. You know, all your faves are problematic. Let's just...
yeah.
Let's be positive, because it's Pulp Fiction. Not to... We said all...
I want to say, this time watching it, and Sean and I recently watched this at the drive-in, like, maybe 6 weeks ago, so I was able to watch for nuances here, because I knew what the plot was.
Right.
You know what I mean? It was fresh in my mind. And I was really taken by how great Sam Jackson is in this. Like, because I remember his character as just being like, you know, a force of nature and like him just delivering the dialogue so beautifully and perfectly. And I thought of it as that kind of performance. But I feel like in that third segment when they go back to the diner, like he actually conveys a lot of depth of character, and you watch his character change as he is talking to himself while he's technically talking to Amanda Plummer.
Right.
And that's not easy to pull off. And I just really think that like our popular consciousness has been, maybe I'm projecting, but I know that I have been doing Samuel L. Jackson a disservice in my memory of this performance. It is much richer and deeper than I thought it was. And even if it were just what it was on the surface, like he probably, I've never seen Ed Wood, so I don't know if Martin Landau deserved his Oscar or not, but like, I would not be upset if Sam Jackson had an Oscar for this at all.
Right.
Oh. Even not knowing now what I do know, that this is a really deep, interesting characterization.
Right. It absolutely is.
And it's not even really there on the page. He made it.
Right. Because I always kind of forget about that last scene with them at the diner and all that stuff.
It's the least iconic chunk of the movie.
Right. Exactly. Like when I think of Pulp Fiction, I think of, you know, them with the dudes, you know, him quoting the Bible verse and all that stuff.
Right.
And taking the bite out of dude's burger. But yeah, that last scene, like him, he pulls off like some tremendous, like really deep, like really great work there with just like you said, like talking to himself whilst talking to Amanda Plummer, whilst talking to Tim Roth, like talking everybody down, and it's like, you know, and having that his moment of clarity.
Yes.
And in that scene, for the way he says, which wallet's yours? The one that says bad motherfucker on it. Because as if to say, if you looked in the bag, you wouldn't have to ask me this wallet.
Right. Come on now. You know.
The thing that struck me this time was I am so glad in the story of this movie that Jules makes it out and Vincent doesn't.
Oh, yeah.
Like, I'm sure that this has been screened places. What an interesting movie the chronological order version of Pulp Fiction is.
Oh, people because have watched that?
I think that's happened.
It seems like a waste of time.
But then I'm thinking about it. And this all is this resonant thing in the middle of the movie, after which Jules is gone because he's walking the earth and Vincent is spinning closer and closer to death. Like, right.
Okay.
That's...
All right.
And if you put this movie in chronological order, it would begin with
Christopher Walken.
The watch with Christopher Walken.
Right.
And end with Zed's dead baby. And that's also a great arc.
Yeah.
Oh, I'm not going to do it.
And what? No, there's no way in hell.
It doesn't get any more of my time.
To the Samuel L. Jackson point, I was thinking about this a lot. As great as Uma Thurman's great, John Travolta's great, Bruce Willis is good, most of the cast is good. But for me, my three stars of the game, to go to the hockey parlance, obviously Samuel L. Jackson and Christopher Walken. Because with anybody else, you just cut that scene.
Right.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Anybody else. It's the only flashback in the entire movie. It's a weird monologue. There are 100 other ways to do it. But it is such a bizarre, compelling monologue,
right,
because of the way Christopher Walken is saying it. But this time...
Also the way the camera's set up. I really love the angle on that shot.
Yeah, because that scene is actually, it it gets rendered unnecessary with basically like two lines from Butch in the presence to just like talk about, you know, how important, why that watch is important. So yeah, you're Christopher Walken. God bless him. And kind of off topic, has Christopher Walken and Jeff Goldblum ever been in anything together? Because I feel like that's...
I'd watch them walk the earth.
But my third star, and this is especially this time and that last time I saw it a couple of months ago, Ving Rhames does not get nearly enough
in
this lineup. Every line he says, like the one that... the Indochina bowl of rice line is like... low-key one of the best line readings in this movie, full of people saying things in interesting ways. But the speech with the back of his head and Butch is and by the end of it I'm like, man, Butch should have taken the dive. He's right.
Right.
I don't think I understood how much money, like, it wasn't, I think for a long time I thought that it was just pride. I didn't realize Butch had bet on himself and was going to make a ton of money off of this. Yeah. It's still stupid,
right? Because now you gotta run. Now you gotta be on the run and looking over your shoulder all the time.
Like, you choose to be a mob lawyer, right? This might be apocryphal, but it is my belief that Stanley Tucci is the person who named Ving Rhames Ving. That before that, his name was Irving.
Why do you think it was Stanley Tucci?
Go on.
Because they both sort of had a big movie that year, and I remember seeing them at, like, I want to say like the MTV Movie Awards or something like that, and Stanley Tucci was like, yeah, you know, I'm the one who named him Ving. So like, I can't remember the exact source. It might have been bullshit to begin with,
right?
But if that is true, how adorable,
right? Like, and I actually just learned, like, the past couple days that his actual full name is Irving, and I was like, wow, that, what a cool shortening of Irving, like,
right?
That's amazing.
And anybody on earth who, like, deserves to have the coolest nickname possible, right? Is Ving Rhames.
Exactly. Yep.
In the meantime, I have googled it, and Stanley Tucci and Ving Rhames went to acting school together at SUNY Purchase. And that is where Stanley Tucci started calling him Ving, and it caught on.
Thanks, Stan.
We went to college together, and he gave me the name Ving. My real name is Irv Ving, Stanley Tucci.
Yep.
I think I applied to SUNY Purchase.
So, speaking of Marcellus, do y'all believe that that's his soul in the briefcase? Is that
no?
Or do I don't even fully believe that that was what Tarantino meant. By, like, is that what he intended?
No, I thought Tarantino was like, it's a MacGuffin. Like, you probably opened it up, and if he didn't think to put a light bulb in, it was just going to say the words MacGuffin.
In one of those things that is 40% pretentious, no, other way around, 60% pretentious, 40% interesting, there's some quote I just saw from him that's like, if a million people see my movie, I want them to see a million different movies. Mm-hmm. For that reason, he deliberately does shit that has no explanation that will actually add up.
Right.
David Lynch does this naturally, and Tarantino forces it awkwardly. But you mean that's like
the gunshots going through them?
The gunshots going through them, and the glow when they shoot, look at the big brain on Brett, and the what's in the case, it comes back in Kill Bill. It's not only not explained, there is no reason why her name is bleeped out for two-thirds of the two movies.
Jesus Christ.
He just throws shit like in like that thinks it's interesting. And that works here enough until you start going, but what is it? And he's like, it's nothing. It's like, shut the fuck up, what is it?
I like the fact, I mean, I think it's fine that it's there or whatnot. I just wasn't aware. I didn't know if Tarantino was trying to pull it off, like, yeah, it's his soul, because, you know, that's why he has a band-aid on the back of his head, blah blah blah. Because what I was going to call out was Tim Roth.
People think that he has a band-aid because his soul got taken out of the back of his head.
Yes.
I thought that people think he has a band-aid because he has 666 tattooed on his neck, because he is working for the devil.
I always thought that he had a Band-Aid because he shaves his head.
Right.
And it's hard to get back there and not nick yourself.
Well, my thought, he had a pimple that he just kept poking at, scratching at. And so now you can't be a gangster with like a weird gash, like a pimple gash on the back of your head. It's better to have a Band-Aid over it. Much like Nelly, I guess, in a way. So, yeah. So that was just one of those things. Because what got me was that when Tim Roth's character is like, is that? And he's like, yeah, it is. And I'm like, I'm sure Marcellus is big in the gangster world, but I don't think he's all like that. Where this two-bit like robbery guy is going, this two-bit, right. Hold up dude is going to know who he is and that his soul was in a briefcase and blah, blah, blah.
Yeah, that does not hold up to scrutiny.
Here are my two questions. One from the same deleted scene that has the Suzanne Vega thing. Part of that's the early part of Mia and Vincent together before they get to the restaurant, where she comes up with one of these little Tarantino talking point theories that every person on Earth is fundamentally either a Beatles person or an Elvis person. You can like them both, but you are at your core either a Beatles person or an Elvis person.
Interesting.
What are you?
I guess Beatles.
I've grown up with the dichotomy being Beatles and Stones.
That's what I thought too.
Definitely a Rolling Stones person. And so I feel like by transitive properties, I have to be an Elvis person.
Okay. It's
basically, how close are you staying to the black music you stole?
Elvis doesn't mean shit to me. Racist. Mm-hmm. Motherfucker. To quote the great Flavor Flav, or Chuck D and Flavor Flav.
None of my heroes ever appeared on a postage stamp.
Exactly. What about you, Sean?
Between the two of them, I'm a Beatles person. If it's Beatles Stones, it's more difficult because I've certainly listened to the Beatles more, but think I'm a Stones person? I don't know. Mm. But that's why I think it actually is true.
I don't own any Elvis albums. I own several Beatles albums.
Right. Beatles Stones is an argument, but if it's a Beatles Elvis duck, then yes, I think she's right. I think everyone is either one of those or the other.
That's funny because I had a theory of like, if you're a 90s kid or like a teenager in the 90s, you're either Singles or Reality Bites.
Singles all the way.
That's where the two.
Mm. Vincent, of course, is an Elvis person. Clearly. And there's an unexplained echo of this in the movie, of that deleted scene in the movie when they pull up at Jack Rabbit Sims. She said an Elvis man should love this,
right? But I just figured she was talking about his hair or something. Like,
me too.
Or just like he just oozes. Yeah, he just oozes.
It makes
like
sense
yeah
to me.
Yeah,
yeah,
yeah. This guy isn't Elvis. Yeah, totally.
I have a question about Mia's outfit. Is she dressed up?
Like, did she take the time to put this outfit together? I think the blazer is a little more.
The blazer makes me think it's an intentional look,
right?
But it's a white button down and black pants.
But like, I mean, check her out though. Like, I think, and like, just going by her outfit, like this broad likes old Hollywood.
Yeah.
So this is what her outfit nod is. You know that why they go to Jackrabbit Slims, and also checking her out at the pool in that one scene, like the way she's like, she's all Greta Garbo'd, like. You know, she's got a thing going. Like she knows exactly what vibe she's sending out, and that's like she's like, yes, I'm old Hollywood.
I also regrettably found out last time I saw this movie at the drive-in that she is in fact not wearing vamp nail polish. This movie was filmed before that was invented.
That's a shame.
Yeah, but it Sorry is definitely for your loss. A big part of the reason that that became such a big thing.
Yeah,
you know, sometimes I like to pretend I don't have a type. When we were watching this over the weekend, Mary Beth was like, man, I've been her for Halloween I've dressed up as Mia Wallace so many times. I know only one other person who has been Mia Wallace multiple times. It's my ex-girlfriend. So apparently.
I feel like Mary Beth wakes up every morning and dresses up as Mia Wallace.
Yeah, I mean, that's not far from the truth. My other question that I wanted to answer here on the show. So is there such thing as an innocent foot massage?
No.
I would not let Colin massage another woman's feet.
Oh, that would be hell to pay if Dan were to touch some other woman. And also, I was telling Dan, I was telling Dan before I had seen this, like a couple weeks ago, that he is the only person I have allowed to give me a foot massage that I was not paying in my entire life. So it's like...
That's love.
So absolutely. There is no such... To me, there's no such thing as an innocent foot massage. And I so yeah, there's no fucking way. I would feel so weird if I were let some dude, like one of my friends, were like, what the fuck? Get off me, man. Like, what?
I don't want any platonic associate to give me kind of any massage. Like, I can pay someone, like you said.
Yeah.
Otherwise, no thank you.
No, no, because I would absolutely have a problem with Dan touching on somebody like that.
Yeah.
I think if you were two single people, you could make the argument that I'm doing a favor.
I would never do it unless I was okay with maybe sex happening after.
Right. Exactly. Like,
that is opening a door.
Right.
Yeah.
You are absolutely right. You're opening the door. It's just like, oh, you want to give me a foot massage? Great. Okay, I'm totally cool. In the back of my head, yes, I'm cool if we bang it out then later. Right. Then so let's do this.
I'm not doing this necessarily because I want to bang it out, but I am opening the door.
If we go that route.
Right.
Well, then that answers the question, because phrased another way, you're saying if there were a human being who you would not have sex with, you would also not accept a foot massage from that person.
Correct.
So, therefore.
Exactly.
Unless it was an exchange of goods and services.
Right.
Right. Your money is on the nightstand.
Correct.
So then, the follow-up question is it an overreaction? I mean, he didn't kill him. He just hurt him real bad.
I love his line. It's like, the motherfucker's just mess up the way the motherfucker talks. I feel like it's a just right reaction for Marcellus Wallace. Like, right. It may be an overreaction for Dan Friedson, but
it's like, this is 50% because of what you did and 50% because you're dumb enough to do it with a mob boss's wife.
Right.
Like, come on.
Exactly.
You clearly also need an education.
Do you know what I would watch if they made a movie about Fox Force 5?
I would just watch Fox Force 5.
No, that's what I mean. Yeah, like,
yeah.
Fox Force 5 sounds great to me.
Right? But, no, it's Kill Bill.
Yeah. Well, I need more jokes.
You need more vaudeville jokes.
Yes.
Yep. Robin, do you want to go into the thing that you messaged us about?
Oh, yeah.
Vehicular
manslaughter?
I say, like, how much a $5 milkshake costs in 2020, because it's $8.79.
Right, exactly.
Every single time I watch this movie, I visit the inflation calculator.
I pay more for milkshakes on that than that semi-regularly. Right. Because of the milkshake factory, it's going to be $9.50.
Exactly.
Really?
Yeah.
Okay. Without booze?
There's no bourbon in it or nothing.
Yeah. But it's a damn good shake.
It is.
Roger Avery is the other person who won an Oscar for writing this movie. He wrote a treatment of the Butch storyline. So that was independent of Pulp Fiction. It was a story for a film that had been written. He and Quentin Tarantino came together with it, and it sort of got absorbed into Pulp Fiction. And so Roger Avery gets a story by credit and won an Oscar for, in air quotes, writing Pulp Fiction. Mm. He also killed someone with his car in the late aughts.
Wow.
And was sentenced to a furlough program. So he's like living his life during the week and then goes to jail on the weekends.
Mm.
He got caught tweeting when he was supposed to be in jail. And so got removed from the furlough program and had to finish his sentence in jail, where he probably just exclusively talked about how he wrote Pulp Fiction and no one believed him.
It's probably right on. And then I also saw that he wrote and directed Killing Zoe, which is another one of those crazy films. I believe Eric Stoltz was the star in that one. I saw that a billion years ago. And Rules of Attraction, which fucked up. Speaking of Less Than Zero, we were talking about at the top of the show. And I guess he continues to work.
I was listening to a completely unrelated podcast, Hey Riddle Riddle, the Improv Riddle podcast. It's funnier than it sounds, where someone mentioned Rebecca Gayhart, and one of the hosts was like, yeah, she killed somebody, I think. I don't know, maybe it was somebody else. And I'm like, what now?
Noxema girl?
I'm pretty sure Rebecca I remember Gayhart, when that happened.
She killed a child. She, like, there was traffic stopped and she went to swerve around traffic impatiently, and traffic was stopped because a small child was crossing the street.
Wow.
And she got probation and like apparently was like really fucked up about it, but fundamentally that was her punishment.
Oh my
was,
God.
Like, fucked she up felt about like, it.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. Finally, just because I can't believe it myself, Esmeralda Villalobos, mispronounced though that is,
Villalobos,
should be Yeah, it should be like that. They keep saying Villa.
Yeah.
Played by Angela Jones of Greensburg, Pennsylvania. For our Pittsburgh listeners, you know where Greensburg is. For other people, that's like if you took Pittsburgh and just went three stages down in, you know, urbaneness, you would get to Greensburg an hour to the east. I assumed this was somebody from one French movie that Quentin saw and flew over like every tiny performer. No, she's just a chick from Greensburg.
She's also in a film called Curdled. Have either one of you ever seen this film?
I haven't seen it, but that's like a cult classic, right?
Yeah, I love this film. It's about these, it's like a dark comedy thing. And I think Matt Dillon is in it too, but it's about this these women who are the cleanup crew basically for homicides inside houses and stuff, like, you know, oh shit, somebody, your family member got killed, so we'll send over a crew to clean up the blood and gore. But yeah, it's a really good film, and I thought that she looked familiar. Wow, Greensburg. All right.
Yeah, well, let's rate it. I am very interested. Let's begin with Robin this week.
Sure. I don't really know. The number that kept hitting my brain was 87, and that's where I'm going.
Camila.
84.
I will go be the high outlier this week and go 93.
That's right about where I was. It's Quentin's fault that he brought it down to 84.
I've never said this is one of my favorite movies. In fact, Kill Bill is my favorite Tarantino movie. But it's like when you said that you started in the negative territory with Friday the 13th and managed to get them. I think I began over 100. It's just, there's too much to like about Pulp Fiction. Like, yeah, that's the magic of it, right? There is so much shit packed in there, and it's all interesting, yeah, fun. Right. And then a few things that pull it back down a little bit.
Right.
Final score is 88. 88 is the final. Our current top is Alien at 89.5. So really, really flirted with it. Nothing has cracked 90. Can anything, when averaging out three people's scores,
right,
actually crack 90?
Yes, I think so.
It'll happen
one
day.
What will it be?
I think it will happen.
To the bingo card, nothing.
Somebody speaks a foreign language.
Oh, yeah.
Bonsoir, Esmeralda Villalobos. Bingo!
Ooh! That's a bingo.
Yay! Bingo! Camila, a bingo! Camila, do you know what movie we're watching?
Wait, I get to pick a movie? I want to say something right off the tip of my... Right out.
Is it Fight Club?
Yes, but
yeah.
I'm going to spend some time with it.
About it. Okay.
And we have some time to figure out if that's Fight Club or if something else speaks to you.
Right, right. Oh, this is exciting.
Programming note, next week we have our trivia winner. We'll tell you more about that. That'll be followed by two of our holiday episodes. And now apparently that will be followed by Camila's Choice.
Woo-hoo.
But before we get to any of that, we've talked for a long time about Pulp Fiction. So let's go to lightning round. You can't handle the truth. Everybody recommend something that it's not a holiday weekend. But every weekend's a holiday weekend. There's a pandemic on. Recommend something for the people to watch.
Yeah, I got nothing. Finish watching Supernatural, because that's what I'm doing.
How much do you have? Like, are you watching all 15 seasons, or are you like deep in and finishing it up?
Oh, I'm finished. I'm like on the last five episodes of the series, because I started binging it when Kaj was born. I was like, I need something. And then when I got halfway through, I've got like several seasons in, I'm like, this show is still on the air.
I watched that show kind of intermittently when it was first on, and then watched like the first six seasons in 2 weeks one summer, and like reached the point of like, I can't keep track anymore. There's too much plot.
Yeah, a lot
too
is
too much plot. And
so
also
much.
It's just too sad.
Mm-hmm.
That show got way too sad for me, and the fact that there were then at least seven more, possibly eight more seasons, is stunning.
Yeah, it jumps the rails a little bit.
My recommendation, because I downloaded Peacock to watch Police Academy and then started diving through Peacock, is the Amber Ruffin show.
Nice.
It is the Amber Ruffin show. So she is a writer for Late Night with Seth Meyers, and she has a once weekly late night show where it's her and her friend Herrick Davis, and it's like two children playing late night in their living room. And like, she's just the most charming, adorable person on earth. And I really think that this show is better than it would be if there weren't a pandemic and she got to have an audience and guests in normal trappings. I think the weirdness of the show makes me like it even more. And it makes it feel like a like going to an improv show at Arcade Comedy Theater, like just people being goofy and doing things that they think are funny. And I get to watch. I watched every episode in 2 days.
Nice.
Very cool. Then yes, Peacock downloaders. And it's on Freecock. Wait, it's on Freecock. That doesn't sound good when you say it like
not
that.
At all.
And then this week I'm going to be watching everything on Stars, which I started my free trial of to watch Pulp Fiction because it turns out I don't own Pulp Fiction. So next week you'll hear me talk about Seduced.
Man, a lot of what I watched is kind of bad. The closest thing to a recommendation, if you like a little, you know, fun thriller to kill an afternoon, that's Run on Hulu with Sarah Paulson. Sarah Paulson is great, underused, underappreciated, got a daughter
I feel
with...
feel like she counts as underused.
Yeah, in life or in this movie?
She doesn't, you know, she's a great actress who doesn't get like big leading parts. She's always in something for 10 minutes.
It's like,
or
I feel like,
or something like Run that's like a little, you know, also ran streaming movie.
Yeah, I feel like Ryan Murphy had like her soul for several years.
Yeah,
it's a fun thriller. It's actually a little darker than you think it's gonna be, so you know, be prepared to go places. But you know, if you need a thing to throw on that isn't a Christmas movie, Run is fine. There's only two drive-ins that have not closed down for the winter, and I went to one basically because I told myself I'm going this weekend no matter what's playing. This led me to watch The Santa Claus and Elf,
which the first time watching Elf,
I had never seen Elf. It's good.
Yes, you're right.
That's
uh-huh,
it.
Uh-huh. Had you been led to believe that Elf was like a masterpiece?
I wouldn't say that. I didn't go in thinking like I will finally see the best Christmas movie of them all. I did think like there's a lot of merchandise for this movie. Okay. Like this movie gets quoted and gifted and tweeted and a whole lot. Is it like amazing? No, it's just funny. Like most Will Ferrell movies are funny, and that's that.
It's just very quotable. It just lends itself well to all of that stuff.
Yeah.
Bob Newhart's great.
Yeah.
Yes.
Santa Claus is straight up bad. Like I've seen people being like, "That's one of my favorite holiday movies," and I'm like, "No, you're just wrong." Like like that VHS you own does not make it a good movie.
I owned that movie on VHS growing up, and yet I don't think I've ever actually watched it.
Is that the one with Tim
Allen? Yeah. Like, I know I've watched the beginning of that movie. I've watched up to the point where he kills Santa.
It's so frustrating. The movie was begging for him to be at the North Pole with him learning to be Santa and all wacky, like he doesn't know how to Santa. Instead, the whole thing is like he's arguing with his kid's mom and stepdad. They're trying to, he thinks he's Santa. We need to keep the kid away from him. He's losing it. It's just like,
maybe I have seen
this done an
movie.
Interesting thing. And instead you did this dumb, like watered down Miracle on 34th Street plot. It's bad, bad movie. But everything's better at the drive-in. If I had been watching that at home, I would have made it 4 minutes. As it was, I was like, this is a movie. I'm looking at it, you know. Well, let's draw a movie. Let's not. Let's watch a movie. Camila, I'll let you set this up. Camila, of course, is the mastermind of Number One Movie in America Trivia Nights. So
what happened was, so last time we had trivia, we gave away the guest spot and to pick a movie on the show. So next week we will have Bill Fisher, who has chosen The Mask of Zorro as his, he was triumphant winner of Trivia Night for us. And it was a special Halloween edition, correctamundo.
Yes.
So horror movies. And so, so that's what we're going to be watching with, is it Anthony Hopkins and Antonio Banderas?
I was hoping you would say it that way. Yes.
Which I am very excited about. Is this our first Antonio viewing?
I think so. I love him.
Yes, yes, yes.
Well, with anticipation of
Antonio Banderas,
at least two of three hosts thinking about making out with Antonio Banderas, and I'm not ruling myself out.
Yeah, you
He's
don't
a
know.
Very handsome man.
You have no idea what this movie holds in store for you, Sean.
That's right.
No. That's coming next week. Before we go, Pulp Fiction was released October 14th of 1994.
Back in New Jersey. Okay.
What was the number one song in America when Quentin took his first trip to the top of the box office?
Nine Inch Nails?
Boyz II Men.
Robin is correct.
On Bended Knee? One Bended Knee, Water Runs Dry.
Nope.
One Sweet Day.
No, that's way later. That's like later? 98. Yeah.
94. That was not yesterday. Fuck. I'll Make Love to You.
Correct.
Yay!
I could give hints, but like...
You didn't want to go there?
How many Boyz II Men songs are there to name? You know,
there's a lot, Sean. There's a lot.
I know. I was like, I'm pulling a surprising number of Boyz II Men tracks out of the archives here.
No tie to be made between I'll Make Love to You by Boyz II Men and Pulp Fiction. Those do not happen in the same world.
I mean, if you touch a woman's feet.
Number one.